Is on congregations as shapers of identity, and my name is Deanne Lagerquist, and I grew up in St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Ames, Iowa. Was for a number of years a member of Trinity Congregation in Cedar Riverside neighborhood of Minneapolis, and I now belong to St. John's Lutheran in Northfield, Minnesota. Now I tell you those congregations because of the topic of this session, congregations of shapers of identity, and if you knew anything about those three congregations, it would tell you some things about me already, and I may allude to some particular things about each of those as we go along. Tonight I'd like to do, while we're in this room, three or four things. I'm going to give you some introduction to my interest in this topic. I'm going to show you some slides to jog your brain and get you thinking about the topic. Then we'll have some small, well, maybe we'll just do it all in one group. I'll give you some paper to think about some questions, and then we'll talk about it. I also hope that if your brain starts here and keeps going, that you would come up and talk to me about this some more during your stay here. My interest in the topic of congregations has several sources. One of the first is that I am a women's historian, and one of the things that historians of American women have found is that the best source material until relatively recent time periods comes from the religious sphere, and more specifically from congregations. So when I was working on my dissertation research, which was about Norwegian and American Lutheran women before 1920, I found that I had to go to local sources, and that the congregational historians paid a lot of attention to women, whereas the denominational historians tended to ignore them entirely. My interest in congregations also comes from the fact that I'm interested in social history, not just what people think about their religion, but how their religion influences them in their day-to-day life. And those things came together very happily in a project that's called the Congregational History Project, where a group of church historians have been meeting together for 2.5 years to consider how we can use congregations to understand American religion more generally. And so this particular topic that we're looking at tonight, congregations as shapers of identity, is my assignment in that group. And I always tell my students that collaboration is a good thing. That you get more ideas and better ideas if you talk to other people, and so that's what I'm doing. I'm enlisting you in my work. That project will have several publications as its outcome. The first volume is nearing completion. It's a collection of micro studies, as it were, of specific congregations, Mother Bethel, AME Zion in Baltimore, a congregational church in New Haven, a Roman Catholic Church in San Francisco, etc. And the second volume will examine more themes, so that mine will be part of a volume that also has an essay on congregation as meeting place between public and private, congregation as transmitter of tradition, and so forth. The large thing that we're interested in is how the local, or to use anthropological terms, the little tradition intersects both with the great tradition, which we could describe as the whole of Christianity or a particular denomination. So the little tradition and the great tradition, and the little tradition and its members. So more specifically, my interest, I tried to devise a catchy little graphic here to see if it works. I'm concerned about the congregation corporately, okay, represented by the building, and the individuals represented by this little stick figure. So we have those two parts, the corporate identity and the personal identity, with regard to three areas, which I call personality, piety, and political activity, because alliteration helps you remember things. By personality, I mean the whole person, everything from being musical. Maybe a congregation has encouraged someone's musical talents, to being shy. If you're a member of a family that's kind of peripheral in the congregation, you may feel like you can't speak. So the personality has to do with the whole person, behaviors, all those kinds of things. Piety, I do that partly because it's alliterated and partly because I have a personal vendetta is too strong a word, but distaste for spirituality. I think we should revive this old word piety, which means essentially the same thing. So if you think spirituality, what I mean by piety is spirituality, but spirituality and corporate religious behavior. So it has to do with worship and personal prayer and I suppose superstitions, if one has those, how all of those things work together. And then finally, political activity. By that I mean, well, everything else, okay? So not just how you vote, although that might be part of it, how you spend your money, how you understand the interaction between religion and other parts of the world. And these three little arrows going two directions are to indicate that I'm interested not just in what goes on inside of a congregation, how its members are bound together, how they're differentiated from each other, but also how the congregation and its members interact with their larger context, whether that's neighborhood, ethnic group, racial group, class, all of these things intersect. I'll say some more about that later. I did write two bibliographic references up here, if this gets you interested. The field of congregational studies is burgeoning, and there's a lot that one could read, but these two in particular I'll recommend. The first is by James Wind, and it's called Places of Worship, Exploring Their History. Especially if you belong to a congregation that's coming up on an anniversary, or something like that, and you want to write the history of your congregation, this is a wonderful resource, and it has good resources in the back also about how to get started and how to get access to a variety of kinds of helps. And that comes from the American Association for State and Local History, and it's just hot off the press this spring. The second one, Congregations, Their Power to Form and Transform, edited by C. Ellis Nelson, is a compilation of essays. And it's more about how congregations function in their larger society. So, what I'd like to do next is show you some slides, not so much for the details of the slides, but just to get your mind sort of jump-started. And as I show those, to talk to you about what a congregation is. A congregation, I would say, is a basic unit of religious life. Some have argued that it's one of the most ancient social groups. And we see congregation as a local kind of unit recorded throughout the New Testament. I mean, the most obvious place, of course, are the epistles to the congregation at Corinth, to the congregation at Galatia, to the congregation at Ephesus, and even as at the beginning I said, if you knew about these congregations that I've been associated with, you'd know something about me. If someone showed up and said, hi, I'm from the congregation at Corinth that Paul wrote to, you'd immediately think a few things about that person. Right? We're also learning that the Gospels were probably addressed to very specific communities, although whether or not we can call those congregations, I don't know, but at least they had specific personalities. The congregation is the building block of the whole church and of the denomination. For many people, the congregation is the church. If you say to someone, "What church do you belong to?" many times they'll respond with, "I belong to St. Mark's Methodist Church," or "I belong to St. Margaret's Catholic Parish." They think at the local level, it's their primary point of contact. In the introduction to this book he edited, Ellis describes congregation in a way that I think is helpful. He says, "First, the congregation is a unique social institution. Congregations are not clubs, yet friendships generated within a congregation are often the best human relationships we know. They are not established to reform or rule society, and yet changes in our social life are rooted in the life and witness of Christians. They are certainly not business enterprises," as my congregational president reminded us recently. "However, congregations through their members are related to much commercial activity, and we do have to have money in them. They are not interest groups for the arts, yet no other institution has supported the arts over a longer period of time or provided more inspiration for music and architecture than have congregations. They are not schools, yet congregations probably spend more time and money on education than any other single activity." And then, what's unique about them? "Congregations are unique because they are a gathering of people who share beliefs and seek to understand and do God's will in the circumstances of their lives. Their constant reference to God, who is in but also beyond life, is what gives congregations a unique status." Now, Jim Wynn, in the introduction to his book on places of worship, cites the Oxford English Dictionary, and he identifies three things. First of all, he says that a congregation is a body of people. Now, I showed you first two pictures of buildings, outside and inside, not to say that's not what the congregation is, but sort of to remind us that buildings are not immaterial, before we then go on to say it's a body of people, he says, who assemble for worship. So here we have them assembling and worshiping. And he points out, with or without a preacher. Because, of course, in the Society of Friends, there's not a preacher. And thirdly, he says, they habitually attend or belong to a particular place. And I put this in. This is wonderful. These are from the inside of Vasa Lutheran near Red Wing, Minnesota. And it's I put it in especially for this little one on the side, because it's so wonderful. This is the pulpit, and this is a Bible holding up the pulpit. I don't know if it's still there. Every time I go to Red Wing, I think, oh, I got to stop and look and see if it's still there.
That's Vasa, did you say?
Vasa.
Yeah.
So, Wynn's,
Swedish.
Yeah. Wynn says it's a body of people who assemble for worship, habitually attending or belonging to a particular place. Now, it's an ancient idea. It's an ancient unit, social unit. Here I've represented it just by giving you this picture of ecclesia, or the church as the mother. But in the American context, congregations are somewhat different than they have been in other places. Let me say three reasons for that. One, in the American setting, congregations are not linked to government. They're separated, as religion is in the U.S. constitutionally. Secondly, membership in congregations is voluntary and optional. Nobody has to belong to a congregation, at least once they move out of their parents' household. It's voluntary, and the standards of membership vary a great deal. The standards of membership in the 19th century were much higher in most congregations than they are now. So we had the phenomenon that there would be bigger numbers for worship than were actually on the rolls, quite unlike what we tend to see today, where the membership roll is really big and the number of people who are ever actually there is quite small. And then a third thing that's important about the American context is the pluralism of American society, that that we have intersection. If you think of the membership of a congregation as a sort of circle, it intersects maybe with family, but not everyone in your family belongs to the same congregation or even to any congregation. And it may also intersect with something like your ethnic group, if that's significant for you. It's no longer significant for a lot of people.
You have some of the family of a different ethnic group.
By marriage. But, yeah, right. And it may also intersect with your work world. Okay, one of my colleagues contends that we should all belong to two congregations. We should belong to one where we live and another one where we work. So this is a sort of pluralism. We live in a pluralistic society, not a traditional society, where presumably these might all be share the same boundary. Okay, a little something about patterns of founding of congregations in the U.S. I'll make particular reference to Lutherans. I had to put these portraits of patriarchs of American Lutheranism in because all my other slides were not taken for this. They were taken for talks on women in religion, and so they're all pictures of women. Some things about how congregations have been founded in the U.S. One way is that persons who immigrated to the U.S. or to the American colonies banded themselves together, lay people, and then requested having already formed a congregation, a pastor. So if you've been coming to Mark sessions on the ministry, it looks, at least from the outside, like it would be way over here on the functional thing because you already have the congregation. But I suppose you could also interpret it on the other side. You have these people gathered together. They don't feel like they're really the church unless they have a pastor. It could go each way. Well, that's how Henry Melchior Muhlenberg got here, because the people in Pennsylvania wanted pastoral care that was German and Lutheran. They might have been able to get German and Reformed, but they wanted German and Lutheran. Another way is by missionary work. And here you see Paul Hankel, who was sort of Tennessee, Carolinas. Like the Methodists, he went out riding around on a horse, looking for people to kind of push them together into congregations. Another way was to raise up lay leadership, like John Stow in Ohio. But in all of these cases, the congregation was first. At least, I don't want to make a theological statement there, I'm making a historical statement. The congregation was first, and then the congregations are joined together in conferences, synods, districts, whatever they were called. And the reason I put up George Svedrup, of course, is because the Lutheran Free Church made that a theological point, that the congregation is the basic unit of the church, much more like the United Church of Christ is now. Okay, what did these congregations do? What were their functions? Especially in the early years here, I'm talking in American Lutheranism sort of in the 19th century, okay, mid to late 19th century. One very important thing was baptism, the sacraments, bringing new people into the kingdom of God through the congregation. We may think of baptism being, you know, you join the congregation, but really it's making them Christians. Education was also very important. Here you see a parochial school. Congregations provided access to reading and writing and those sorts of things. They also had religious education in mind, and here you see some Luther's catechisms in English. I think it's
a sacrament of Heiligen Taufe.
That's German.
German. Yeah. Okay. I put that up there because the congregation had not only religious educational function but also an ethnic one. So that the parochial summer schools in the plains of Minnesota and the Dakotas, one of their functions was to teach children Norwegian or Swedish or German or whatever the native tongue was. And then to integrate those children into the community. Here you have confirmation. One thing someday I'll figure out is when they went to white dresses. Go back just a few years, they all had on black dresses. I think this also reminds us of the overlap with the family.
Boys and girls are separated.
Boys and girls are separated, yeah. Then there are other life cycle things that congregations helped to mark. Weddings, wedding anniversaries. Again, the family, the neighborhood intersect with the congregation. Funerals, of course, very important. Congregation, many congregations formed, the first thing they did was get a graveyard. Building comes later. But the first thing you need is a cemetery. And that's true of many ethnic groups that formed any kind of ethnic society. Frequently, the first thing that was formed was a burial society, because the worst thing people could imagine was, you know, that you'd, if you were an Irish Catholic, you know, that you'd die in Boston and you'd be buried by some heathen Protestant. You know, you want to be buried the right way. Okay, and then communion was less frequent than it is now, so that's why you don't have a picture of it in those early years. This is the first building at Vasa. The buildings were small to begin with. Then they got a little bigger as the congregations got more money, more people, and they began to be able to divide themselves into subgroups. Oh, that's another, they got better stuff in their in their building. So here we have a new altar painting and the artist who painted it. Okay, you could divide into groups. So here we have a worship leadership from a choir, a ladies' aid society, the Decora, one of the Decora churches sewing circle at work, a youth group, and then there are various activities that the congregation belongs to. Once you have a better church, you have to clean it. But also then there gets to be some kind of outreach. And frequently that outreach will be to one's own kind. Here is an orphan's home. But not always. Here's an Indian mission. I think it's many farms in Arizona. Okay, and sometimes there was real social ministry that went beyond one's own group, and frequently that was carried out by deaconesses. Okay. Then, just zipping through history, by the mid-1900s, I really should have a suburban church to indicate the move to the mid-1900s. The number of internal subgroups grows. There's much more differentiation within the congregation. Now, these are very hard things to pin down. I spent about 2 week period reading 100, just about 100 congregational anniversary histories, trying to find out things like, when did they start having coffee? When did they start having couples club? When did they start having a mother's group and a professional women's club in addition to the mission society? The women's organization started describing themselves in different ways, not as the ladies' aid, but as circles, a shift to Bible study. Sometimes there were men's groups. Lots of different kinds of subdivisions within the congregation. Education continues to remain important. Here we see some prayer and mission materials. Sunday school, of course, continues to be very important. Confirmation. And then this is the Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Nebraska. And I put it up there because each of those says welcome in a different language. Also in the 50s, there seems to began and into the 60s, more shifting between congregations, more mobility, new people are coming. That's one of the things I was trying to figure out about coffee hour. Was it a diminishment of the old thing when you'd stay all day you know, so it's less than what we used to have? Or was it a recognition that people didn't know each other anymore and we needed to do something about that? And of course, nobody writes that down that I can find. So new people, more movement between congregations. Some of what I sometimes describe to my students as the in-law factor. Marrying between kinds of groups so that people move not only between congregations, but maybe between kinds of Lutheranism, between denominations. So you began to get sort of cross-fertilization. And other kinds of strangers, one of the things that Lutherans can be proud of is our efforts of resettlement, both after World War II and then more recently with Southeast Asians. Worship in a variety of ways continues to be important. Baptism, communion, and of course that's a real Lutheran way of describing how you know where the church is. So that worship and this reference to God that Ellis points to continues to be distinctive of what congregations are, in contrast to the Elks Club, to your local NOW chapter, to the bowling league, other kinds of social groups that we find ourselves in. Okay. Like most groups, congregations have a sort of corporate culture, personality. Each one takes on a character. There are lots of typologies that have been proposed of ways to divide them into groups. And I'm not going to give you any of those because you could make them up as well as anybody else can. If you're interested, this book lists about three different kinds of typologies of congregations, and Wind has another one that he uses. Some people would say that a congregation should be a faith-based alternative community. It's different. It's in but not of the world. It's the place that you go where you are separate from, distinct from the rest of your life. But it also overlaps with all of those communities. And these sorts of things that I described up here, and some scholars describe that overlap as a sort of elective affinity, that one of these things becomes dominant. One of the congregations in my town has lots of families with young kids. Okay, and so families with young kids tend to go to that congregation, right? And if you don't have young kids, I suppose it might encourage you to have some in self-defense or convince you to go to a different church. It isn't. That's the one we've chosen. The congregation is also described as being an open system. It may not always feel that way, but it is an open system in that it's voluntary. It's a voluntary organization, something Americans are famous for. That voluntariness is, of course, limited by certain factors, by accessibility. Where is it? You know, this is a big deal now about handicapped accessibility. If you have a church that nobody can get in, they're not going to come there. Or if it's hard to get to because it's not on the transportation routes. Language can be a factor. I know I have read and talked to people who say that their parents, who did not speak English, sent them to the congregation in town so they would learn English. It was also an argument in many ethnically based congregations for switching to English, that the young people would stop belonging if you didn't change to English. Scheduling can be a factor. I haven't read about it so much with worship services, but I do know of at least one congregation, I think it was in Racine, that had a special women's organization for domestics that met on Thursdays. Because a lot of Scandinavian women worked as domestics, and Thursday was the day they got off. And if you had a meeting on other days, they couldn't come. The style of worship all of these kinds of things can influence how open a congregation is, and it also influences, I think, the kind of individual personality, piety, and political activity. As the congregation goes, some of the people will go. Now, we should always recognize that there are some people who won't be like the majority and think that's fine, and some who will find it very oppressive. So when I think about congregation of shape or of identity, I think we have to think not only positively, but negatively. I'm thinking about, I was hoping some of the people from Spirit of the Lakes might come, because we might get some real interesting stories from them about congregations being oppressive and diminishing their self-esteem and their identity.
You should get that in the forum. The forum topic is
Okay. So my interest is in the way that this congregation's corporate culture is communicated to its members by a variety of means, whether that's rituals, creeds, sermons, architecture. I don't know about you, but I grew up in a congregation of very distinctive architecture. It was a Selvig church, if you know church architecture. It's real plain, cement floor, red brick. And so unlike many people who walk into a church and they want it to look like a church, if it looks like a conventional church, I feel kind of uncomfortable. I want that big open space because of where I grew up. Understandings of leadership, formal and informal education, and finally social interaction, I think, is really important. I went to watch our congregation softball team play a couple days before we left to come to Holden, and suddenly I thought, oh, now this is a way, and this is the thing. We have this church softball team, and we were playing the blue team from the Catholic Church, and the two Methodist teams were there ready to play each other. Something was going on, nonetheless, that was binding members of the community together. And they were playing together on the softball team. And then when you see each other in church on Sunday, you can talk to each other. Well, I've talked quite a bit. What I'd like to do now is put up some questions. And let's stand up. Give you each a piece of paper and something to write with. I would like to collect these. If you don't want me to have them, of course, I won't force you to give them to me. I won't know if it's any use to me until I get them. But I hope that I'll get a little information from you that I might be able to use. What I'd like you to put on there, first of all, just some data. And then I have three discussion questions. First of all, your name. The reason I want that is if you write something that's extraordinarily interesting and I want to track you down, but if you don't want to put it on, of course you don't have to. Your age and your sex. Then how many congregations have you belonged to? List some that have had a significant influence on you. Just the name and what town it was in, maybe. And then four questions about the congregation you now belong to. What is its denomination? What is its size? Small, medium, large, I guess. Is it rural, suburban, or urban? And what state is it in? And then it may be, given what the time is, that you just want to write about one of these discussion questions. Pick out the one that seems most fruitful to you. The first is, describe one example of how one congregation in five has influenced you. So if I were to do that, one of the things that I might write about is the importance of lay leadership in St. Andrew's Congregation in Ames, Iowa, and how that has influenced me and my view of myself as a lay person my view of a lot of things about lay people. I see all of you counting off on your fingers. You know, approximately. If you miss one, it's okay. 8. How is your present congregation like or unlike the one you grew up in? If you grew up in one. Maybe that you didn't grow up in a congregation. And then, if you selected your present congregation, that is to say, if you had more than one to choose from, what kinds of factors were important? And here I just have some examples of things that might have been important. Denomination, size, language, location, invitation, theology, social political climate, worship, other. So why don't you take about 5 minutes. Think about those things. And I think it's a... well, you think it, you work on it for 5 minutes and I'll decide how we're going to discuss it. Well, you're right.
Could you explain again what you want with number 5?
Just, when I introduced myself, I listed 3 congregations that I'm from. I belong to a bunch of other ones. But each one of those, I could say something about why it was important. That was a congregation that has made me who I am.
Did you want just the name?
Just the name.
Name and place?
Name and place, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And partly that's to get you thinking about which of those, however many you counted up, matter. Are you far enough along that some people are ready to start talking? Maybe we could just start with this thing that Anne said. Oh, you mean not everyone chooses their congregation by denomination? How many of you choose a congregation by denomination?
That's not exactly what I meant. What I meant was I took it so for granted that I would be part of a Lutheran congregation that isn't even a factor.
That's right. You wouldn't even think about it. Mm-hmm. Most of you are
I wouldn't
in
even
that
consider
camp.
Another denomination.
Really? Well, then you're an unusual group. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was in chapel communities because of teaching, and they were non-denominational.
Right. So
non-denominational Protestant.
If you don't, the possibility of not joining a congregation of your denomination doesn't even occur to you. What are the things that are important?
I think one thing in looking, and I would do it the same way again, but many of us are maybe rather placid in the whole thing and wait for a pastor to call on us. Maybe the one that's most assertive is the one that we join.
Okay.
You know, in retrospect now, I think if we were going to join a church now, we would probably be a lot fussier in going around and checking them out.
Shopping.
That's right.
Which is an example of that voluntarism, which is so American, that we think you pick one, not a parish where, well, like the LDS ward system. If you live between this street and this street and this street and this street, you belong to this one. And if it gets too big, they just divide it. These people are in the new one, these people are in the old one. And then if it gets too small, they mush some more people on the edge, like a congressional district or something.
They'll even use one facility for several states, won't they?
Yeah, I think they sometimes do. Yeah. What other things are important?
The assertion.
Okay.
We had the luxury in the Twin Cities as Lutherans of having a lot of options.
Right.
And we intentionally selected 15 years ago, when we moved back to the Twin Cities from the East Coast, a small congregation in a city of fairly large Lutheran churches. We sought out a small one.
And why
we
was
wanted to be part of a smaller, more intimate community.
Okay. Do you think that's relevant for this question of identity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was for us.
Yeah. Well, could you say more about why?
Well, to use the other extreme, we're right next door to Mount Olivet, and Mount Olivet is the largest Lutheran church in the Western Hemisphere. And we explicitly did not select Mount Olivet because of its size. We did not want to be anonymous, I guess. We want to be involved.
So
we wanted to know our fellow worshipers.
Not just the question of shaping identity, but having identity.
Having to help shape, yeah.
Yeah, and how, which is an important point that I haven't made much of, but I think that this is very much a reciprocal process, that the members of a congregation give the congregation its identity.
Right.
Mark.
And being a smaller, being a bigger fish in a smaller pool, you have more opportunity to help shape what it will be.
Our church right now is losing members because of Sunday school for children and confirmation training. So that seems to be a strong factor in choosing.
Because it doesn't have those.
It doesn't have sufficient numbers to have a good educational program.
It gets fewer numbers.
Terrible.
And that really has to do with shaping people. Mm-hmm. And some would say that's why. Why many Americans return to church is because they have kids and they want their kids to have some religious something.
And that was certainly a fact in the church that we chose. We had the option to go to some smaller ones, but from a programming point of view, you need a certain critical size to be able to offer programs that we were interested in, Sunday schools, this and that, whatever. So that was a major factor, looking at a kind of a medium size to be large enough to have a staff to offer programming.
Okay, are there other specific things? You said this and that. I'd be interested
location,
in what...
style of service.
In addition to Sunday school, what other programmatic things did you look for?
Some groups, Bible study groups, their outreach program, just those sorts of things. I wanted a church big enough to have a staff setting as opposed to just one pastor.
Huh. Why was that?
I like that much better from a couple of reasons. That way, if one pastor isn't perhaps quite as strong as the other, at least you get a 50-50 shot of...
That says keep all your bases covered.
Yeah, but I think it's stronger from a congregation point of view. I feel, I don't know how various pastors in the room feel, that I would think for them it would be a much more growth experience, or being able to interact with someone on staff with boss ideas, try new things out, share the world, whatever. So that was a very an upfront decision on ours. We wanted a church with two pastors. This way, one is male, one is female.
When you thought about the reasons that you chose the congregation that you chose, are those things that are like congregations you've belonged to before? No? Dan, you're shaking your head.
Well, one of my main ones is I was finding a curse that the church was affirming of gay people, and that's very unlike the ones I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And it narrows down the list pretty quickly. But it wasn't the only factor, because I also, theology and liturgy are really important to me. I could go to metropolitan community churches, but their theologies and liturgies are so different than what I'm comfortable with that I haven't. And so that combination narrows pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And I think most congregations are composed of people who say, well, this is really important to me. Liturgy is central to my piety. I need a place with, or good music, you hear that one a lot. And as a non-musician, I'm always sort of amused by that, because people say, oh, is the music good? Well, yeah, we get to sing lots of hymns. That's what good music means to me. But that they'll choose good music and compromise on something else that's secondary.
I know people have chosen their whole worship and congregational life based on the quality, and I mean the high level quality, you know, fine soloists, very good instrumentalists. They want, go to Orchestra Hall. That's what they want out of church. It's fine. Very interesting.
Well, people like Riverside Church in New York, that's yeah. always real high on that's why it. People go there. It can be anonymous, and it's fantastic music.
But other people would go
you
to
Riverside. You hear that from all the people, too. Mm-hmm. Always good yeah. music, and it's like cares a good that. Concert.
But Riverside Church has that other long heritage of being the forefront of a lot of social justice issues, which means that congregations' personalities can be, it's maybe better to talk about them as family personalities than individual personalities, because you can have the wonderful example of this I heard from Russell Hale, one of his colleagues, lived in a suburb where the guy came around, I'm starting this new church. And she said, well, I have a church, I don't want to join your church, but I'm a sociologist, I'm interested in what you're doing, tell me about it. And this guy was going to start a new congregation, get a big building, he's going to have two congregations. The Sunday morning congregation, which he thought of as sort of a civil religion congregation, people who liked good music, people who wanted a Sunday school, maybe, people who wanted to be seen. And then he was going to have the real believers, Wednesday night congregation. And he was very conscious of that, two congregations that overlapped. You know, if we go back to our circles, all of the people in the real congregation are part of the civil religion congregation. And there are other ways to talk about that. One, I think it's a cultural anthropologist study. I think it's an AME church in Pittsburgh, and he made these great seating charts to show, and they came out wonderfully, to show the, not the, the formal organization of the church, but the sort of underlying power structure. And he found that the core members who make all the decisions sat in a sort of round area. Here's the altar, and they all sat like this. And you could find them in that area. And then you said, of course this wouldn't happen everywhere, you'd want to be careful about being in every congregation, but it really moved out. And then the people who were most marginal kind of scattered. They had these core people, and then another group, he had about four groups. And you could see by the way they sat. Always remember, for some people sit up in the front because they can't hear, or you know, in the back because they have kids because they don't want to bother people. So every congregation has people who are more or less influenced by that congregation, and some may find it very positive, very affirming, and in continuity with the congregation's character. Where others will say, oh yeah, that congregation was really influential on me. It made me leave the church completely. You know? Yeah.
Recently, have you done any study or looking at how much, if any, change there is with the pastor's role in the joining the congregation as opposed to the, you know, the congregational unit as similar to a family unit?
Mm-hmm.
Contrasted against the pastor's own charisma,
I think it varies because it would be hard to make a real good generalization because, for example, Methodists who have a rotating system, you know, where every 3 years they move, that's different than Lutherans where we sometimes have real long tenure.
Well, ALC did a study just before it went out of business, you know, Milo Berkey.
No, I don't know.
What Lutherans can learn about evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
The single most important reason why people join the Lutheran Church, not why they come, nor why they stay, or why they leave, is the pastor as person.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you cluster it, it shifts over to something for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the number one reason was the pastor is perceived to be a warm and caring person. So that's quite an extensive study, and it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's available in a little paperback thing now.
And very recently, there was a report in the Lutheran magazine about healthy congregations, mm-hmm. and it sort of played down that aspect of the pastor. But, I mean, everyone sort of realizes, I think, that probably was the most important thing in congregations that were extremely healthy and dynamic, was the personality of the pastor or pastor.
I think we get into real interesting, healthy and dynamic may not always be able to be joined with a conjunction, because I think a lot of dynamic ones have they're pretty dysfunctional with the pastor as a very charismatic leader and a lot of stuff going on there that may sustain itself over some period of time, but whether that's a healthy place to be.
Dan, what have you discovered about people's criteria changing? I'm finding myself right now in a real schizophrenic position with my criteria for congregation feeling fulfillment in my congregation rapidly changing. I'm in a kind of a crunch. My congregation has been my home since I was a child. I've always struggled and I enjoyed fighting with them because they're so stuffy. But now I have felt a lot of promise about a year ago when I got a new pastor, but now change is not happening fast enough for me. I'm kind of, inclusive language is not coming. We just hired a second pastor, male. And I'm ready to call it quits with these people that I've given my whole, I've not been an active leader in that congregation. Also, I have a feeling that I can, you know, push and pull and prod and contribute out thousands of hours, and I will never be the person that I could be for them if I was married.
Yeah.
So I found this congregation real nearby, and I'm splitting my worship time right now between the two. And it's really dinky, and it's like kind of like folded really informal, like this big file cabinet in the middle of the sanctuary. And they bring their groceries on food shelf day, they bring them right into the sanctuary and dump them on a table. And there's this critical mass of single women that kind of run things. And I'm real happy there. But I'm in this position as I've given so much to my congregation over the years, and I can't quite let loose. But it's making me more and more annoyed.
Go ahead.
That comment you made earlier about Sunday mornings is civil religion and Wednesday night is the real church. There's something to that, and that may be a solution in a situation like that, to get a base Christian community going, if you like, besides the formal one.
I think that's happening.
I don't think there's any base Christian types in my congregation.
It starts with new people coming in. It starts at a different hour, it starts with a different order of things, with a different liturgy, with a different
people. Well, then they may as well just go to a different church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
it's the redemption process. You can't just give up on that group. It gave what it's...
Guilt me. I can't give up on it after all this time. I don't know. I think the people that are coming in that are new don't have enough Lutheran background to satisfy me either. They don't know enough about the Lutheran church and they frustrate me.
But one of the elements of the space Christian idea is that you find it together amongst yourselves.
Maybe, yeah.
The truth or the grace or whatever doesn't come from the end of the building. It comes among us. And we can have some good experience if one's open to it. Anyway.
Well, thank you. I don't intend to draw this all together, but merely to get you thinking. And as I said, if you've started thinking... you want to expand on something that you wrote down on your sheet, I'd be delighted to talk to you about it. And I would like to take your sheets, and Susan would like it very much if you gave back the writing utensils. And I'd like it too, because otherwise she'd be mad at me. Thank you.